Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. It once again, I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show on the Blog Talk Radio Network, sponsored by Los Angeles Community Policing and the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. My name is Bill Murray and I am myself an adult survivor of child abuse, as will be most of the people that come on the show this evening. A few others may be people who are interested in the issue, supporting us, and the issues that revolve around the giant issue of doing whatever we can to put a dent in the statistics, the horrible statistics that surround child abuse, which comes in four flavors, by the way, not just sexual abuse, but also violent or physical abuse, and thirdly, emotional trauma, and fourthly, neglect. And neglect, actually, of the four of them, may be the biggest statistically of all. Fully 50% of our children, according to the CDC, may fall into the category of experiencing one of those four by the time they're 18 years old in today's world. And that's a really unacceptable figure. So we do these shows and we encourage community participation when we do them. And half of our shows are about our shows where we have open mics, and about half are special guest shows. And tonight, we have a very special guest, the lovely Rachel Grant, who is in our chat, or excuse me, our green room, sipping her coffee. Don't be nervous, Rachel. I'll get to you in a second here. Rachel's a terrific and inspiring, basically a coach, and she's going to talk to us from San Francisco, and I'd say we'll get to her in just a minute. There are two ways for you to participate in tonight's show. First of all, our chat rooms are always open during the entire show on all the shows we do. And the best way to use a chat room is to have a screen name at Blog Talk Radio and be logged into the system as you come into this chat room, because otherwise you'll be listed as a guest. And while you're, of course, welcome as a guest, guests can only read what other people type. And people with screen names, of course, can type back and forth. And we sometimes have pretty interesting conversations that go on in the chat room. So it's our recommendation, if you've never done so before, to take the 1 minute that it will take to click on a login button at the Blog Talk Radio website. I think it's in the top right corner of some of the pages. And if you don't have a login name, it'll give you instructions on how to create a screen name and a password. And once you do, you'll be logged in, and in subsequent visits, you'll be recognized. And you'll come into the chat room under that name then, and you'll be able to type. The second way to participate is by calling in directly on our phone lines. We're going to open our phone lines up in a little while, but at first, we do have some panelists that we want to get introduced quickly. While Rachel is patient, this is the last thing we'll do. I have at least two that I see here tonight. First of all, he logged in as early as he possibly could, so he could be the first one up. This is Carl Hart from St. Louis. Carl is one of the 200 men who appeared on the Oprah Winfrey shows in late 2010 by way of showing off on back-to-back Emmy Award-winning hour-long shows that child sexual abuse is not just an issue for little girls, but also for little boys. He since then has joined the Just Tell organization at justtell.org. They're a terrific group that we fully support, and they deal with teenagers. And for NASCA, he coordinates our special guests, and he is also the coordinator of our Blue Ribbon campaign. He's the one that actually physically mails out Blue Ribbon requests when we get them. So Mr. Trophy himself from St. Louis, Carl Hart. Hiya, Carl.
Hi, Bill. I'm a busy person, that's for sure.
You certainly are. Ooh. Okay, and that's all the time we have for tonight. So join us again tomorrow. No, I'm kidding. Our second panelist is Carol D. Levine. Carol D. Levine, we always use her middle initial because she's an author, and you need to use her middle initial to find her book, Panic Child, The Harrowing True Story of Sexual Abuse and Neglect. Carol D. Levine is 30 years into her own recovery journey, and she considers herself roughly 85% healed most of the time, sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less. But Carol D. Levine's Panic Child, The Harrowing True Story of Sexual Abuse and Neglect is autobiographical, and you should get it and read it. It's a terrific read, and boy, it just tells you all the things that she went through in her life to get to where she is today. Carol calls in from New Jersey. Hi, Carol. How are you tonight?
Oh, I'm fine, Bill. Thank you. Hi, Carl.
Carl's
no. Yeah, he can't hear. Not yet.
Yeah. Okay. all right. Okay, guys. That looks like the extent of our panel. We'll see if other people call in. But we're going to have a very nice talk tonight, I can tell. Rachel Grant's energy is terrific. She's kind of bubbly and energetic and upbeat, and yet she herself is a survivor. She's calling in tonight from San Francisco, and she is a coach that specializes in trauma recovery and relationship issues. And we're going to find out more about that in just a moment, but let's first welcome to the air Ms. Rachel Grant. Hi, Rachel.
Hello, Bill.
So how was that for an introduction? Did I do okay?
You did great. Thanks so much.
All right. I warned you earlier that you become a member of our family. That didn't seem to bother you too much.
No, not at all.
Wait till you get to meet Carl and Carol on a right. You know, when we can let them talk here next, and you'll have to reconsider, I think.
I'm sure we'll all get along just fine.
Well, of course you will. Seriously, I mean, we're
now, right?
Exactly. Everybody can use one. You know what I mean? this is a very serious, you know, effort for us. We have a lot of fun too. We have some light moments and so forth. But underneath it all, it's a really serious topic. And you know, we exist at NASCA to, as I tried to explain earlier, to simply to raise awareness and chip away at the taboo of talking about these issues, because unless we can get the general population to be comfortable about talking about these issues, we're not going to get any change. And, of course, those of us who are adult survivors, meaning that we experienced some kind of abuse in our childhood where we did not get any help, but later came into our adulthood and took a while, but eventually found a healing journey, as Carol calls it. We are the spokespeople for the children that don't have a voice, who are suffering now or are being set up to suffer, because there's, you know, millions of American children. We're talking 1 in 4 girls, of course, and 1 in 6 boys who will be sexually assaulted, and an equal number will suffer from the other kinds of child abuse or more, before they're 18 years old. And that's just, to us, unacceptable.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a staggering statistic. And I always am overwhelmed by that statistic, additionally, because it's only there from reported cases. So, you know, once you toss me, who I never reported my abuse, so it didn't become, you know, a part of any register of statistics. So that number is probably even higher than what we have recorded when it comes to all the children out there who are suffering and, you know, don't go on to report their abusers.
You're right, Rachel. In fact, we think it's significantly higher. I mean, as you say, you know, and we always remind people, these statistics or the crime themselves, as far as those who keep the statistics, like law enforcement groups, they don't exist unless the crime is reported. Otherwise, they don't exist. And 9 out of 10 children, they tell us, approximately 9 out of 10 children do not tell in their youth, which means mm-hmm. that 9 out of 10 of us come into our adulthood, of course, you know, being dramatically affected by the various symptoms that arise from keeping the secret, because most of us do not want to reveal that we had abuse. We never did it. We didn't reveal it in our youth, and we're darn if we're going to repeat it in our adulthood, and yet it affects just every aspect of our life in some ways, really tragically. And those of us that are lucky really get to a place where we are offered help, or we hear that there is help available and we take it, and we get into what we call a recovery path or a healing or however you want to call it. And you're, of course, part of the group of people who are trying to help out in that respect. And we're going to talk the bulk of the time on the show about the solution and some of the things that you specifically do, Rachel, but I first wanted to ask you if you would please tell us a little bit, as you mentioned it, you were an abused child yourself, if you would tell us a little bit about your youth and the story of how you grew up in your abuse, and so that we can have a little bit of identification with you, and those that are listening can identify with you as well. So as much or as little detail as you want in your own language, just give us a synopsis, if you would, of how it was when you grew up.
Sure. So I actually grew up in a small town in Oklahoma in a fairly, you know, middle class, comfortable family, had mom, dad, and my grandfather also lived with us from the age of when I turned 5. And I was the youngest of 3 children, so my older brother and sister were much older, and by the time I was around 10 years old, they were, you know, in their teens, or my brother was, you know, off to the army. So it was pretty much me, you know, running the house and being in charge, I'd like to think. So I had a pretty close relationship with my grandfather in the sense that he was kind of a constant presence, and I nurtured him quite a bit. He was kind of a quiet companion. I don't remember lots of, you know, sitting around telling stories and talking, but I certainly just remembered kind of the comfort of his presence and doing a lot of caregiving type of things. And, you know, just kind of bringing him his, you know, cereal in the morning or whatever. And so one day he would often go out and sit on the front porch, and I would help him out to the porch a little bit. We had this kind of springy screen door, so I would hold that open for him so it wouldn't knock him over. And one day he just kind of grabbed my arm and said, "Let's sit down," you know. And so I just went over to the porch with him, a porch swing with him, and we sat. And I didn't think anything of that. It's just, you know, okay, we're going to spend some time together. But that day he began molesting me. And that first experience, I think as many people can identify with, you're just completely caught off guard. You don't really know what's going on. I was 10 years old. You know, I didn't know anything really about sex or, you know, any of this stuff. I hadn't really started developing. So I pretty much just kind of froze, and I managed to eventually, you know, kind of snap out of that and ran away. But the abuse continued for some time, and there are parts that are kind of vague in my memory and other parts that are very, very clear and that I resonate with quite a bit. And so over, you know, the next couple of months, this went on, and I wasn't able to tell my parents. I wasn't sure what to say. You know, it's also a very common feeling and sensation is you just, you know, how do I even describe what's going on? I don't even have the words to explain it. And was, of course, quite scared and bothered by what was going on. And eventually one day my mother was walking by the window right by the porch where the abuse often occurred, and she glanced out and saw what he was doing, and you know, immediately kind of came out on the porch and yelled at me to get inside. And pretty soon after that, you know, they moved him out of the house, which was great, and you know, put me in therapy and got me some help. But I was pretty resistant growing up to the support, and didn't want to kind of stay in therapy, didn't want to talk about it, didn't want to face it. And I spent a lot of time through my teen years really struggling as a result. And I think my parents, they did the best they could, but were also very unsure of themselves and how best to support me. So in many ways, just kind of retreated and remained loving and gentle and caring, but it just didn't really kind of push the issue to give me the support that I and help that I needed at the time. So my teen years were pretty rough, filled with, you know, a lot of fears about kind of self-worth and value, and definitely confusion about relationships and love and intimacy. When I was 11 years old, my grandfather died while I was away at summer camp. And I just stayed at camp. I just said, you know what, I'm not going home for the funeral. I'm staying here and enjoying my summer. And so that was, you know, I had seen him, you know, maybe once or twice before that. So that was my basic experience with abuse.
Now, is this your mom's father or your dad's father?
It was my mom's.
Mm-hmm. So she caught her own dad with his granddaughter in molesting you on the front porch, huh?
Yeah.
That must have been horrible for her. Have you ever reflected on how she felt about that? You must have been devastated for her too.
Absolutely. You know, the way that she responded in the moment was kind of yelling at me, like, "Rachel, get in the house," in a very like, "You've done something wrong" kind of tone.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
in the moment, you know, and she kind of pulled me into the house and was kind of, I don't remember exactly what she said, but I just remember the sensation of her kind of being over me and like talking very sternly to me, like, "What's going on?" And for me, and I talk a lot about this in my work, that there are these moments, there are these experiences that we have where out of that experience, we develop an idea or an interpretation or a belief. And for me, in that particular moment, I really thought, "Oh my God, this is my fault. Like, she's not yelling at my grandfather. She's yelling at me." And it wasn't until much later, like in my 20s, when I began developing the program Beyond Surviving and doing, you know, really digging into more deeply into this work, that I went back to that moment and I thought, you know, what might have been going on for my mom? Mm-hmm. And really noticed that, man, she's probably scared out of her mind. You know, she just wants to get me away from him. She doesn't know what's going on. She's been totally impacted as well. And so through doing that sort of work of going, you know, back to the reflection and looking at what else might be going on, it really started to free me from that belief of, you know, it's my fault.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you why I ask, Rachel, is there's some new information on our website that I have not mentioned on the air before. I put it on today. But it comes from a woman who explored the reaction that she had when she found out her husband was molesting her child. It was not her husband's child. It was a child from a previous marriage. But she had married this man and been with him for a number of years and had a couple of kids with him. And then she discovered that her oldest daughter was being assaulted by him. And it took some coming and going and kicking him out and letting him back and kicking him out again and so forth. But the point is that she wrote a series of things. Now, this is a few years back, a series of things that originally came out as pamphlets and representing now as articles on her, all the things that went through her mind as a mother who discovered that her child was being molested by someone she thought she could trust right in the house. You know, and so a really similar kind of experience. People will find these pamphlets that she wrote pretty fascinating. And actually, a couple of them, she's joined by the now 20-something daughter who has her own child, who finally has a better relationship with her mother. But she overreacted to the mother's reaction, and the mother and the daughter's relationship also suffered because of the trauma that the whole house went into trauma. You know,
People
will find that interesting.
No, I'm really excited to hear about that as a resource, and that there are something, and that you bring that up as a topic, because in some ways I think that the family members are almost silent victims. You know, we put a lot of attention on the person who was abused, and certainly they need that, and certainly they need the help and the support, but it really is, especially if, you know, the abuse is right in the family, it's a family problem, and each person is dealing with that trauma in their own way, and they have their own thoughts and their own experiences, and come away from that with their own kind of programming and false beliefs and ideas about, you know, I'm certain, you know, my mom in some ways struggled with, you know, how did I not see that? You know, surely there was something I could have done. How did I not know
exactly
that was happening? You know,
exactly,
all of those sorts of things, and
yeah,
the guilt and the blame. Yeah.
Well, and people will find, I think they will find this interesting. I was interested enough to, I recreated them now as, I think there are 9 or 10 of them total. They originally were pamphlets, and I've made them into, you know, an article, web article for each one. So, and as I say, some of them are, she's joined by her daughter, and all the artwork that's associated is by her daughter. It's pretty disturbing stuff, pretty powerful imagery. Anyway, it happens to be a similar thing to part of your story, so I wanted to bring it up. Let's ask Carl and Carol to come on, and one at a time, but I'll ask Carl first to make any comment or ask any question he'd like of Rachel Grant about what he's heard so far. Carl, you're on the air with Rachel.
Well, Rachel, finally we get to talk.
Hi, Carl.
Carl. Hi there. We've emailed back and forth, but we're finally talking. First of all, I will have to say that I've left my heart in San Francisco, even though my last name is Hart. I don't mean that one. I mean, I lived out up in the Haight-Ashbury for quite a while. And unfortunately, just because of the financials and the cost to live in San Francisco, I've had to move back to the Midwest. But so I'll tell you that part. Second of all, I know that on your site you offer a free initial consultation, and I just want you to know that my ulterior motive in inviting you on as a guest is I want all the free counseling I can get on air, so please feel free to call back in every night. And finally, I do want to ask a question. Did you ever explore with your mother whether or not her father had abused her, and if that was you don't have to tell me, I'm just kind of curious, because a lot of times we know that perpetrators are serial perpetrators or will continue to do things like that and don't stop at just one victim. I was just wondering if you had ever explored that with your parents and whether or not maybe that's why she reacted the way she did, or if there was some, like, oops, I should have been more careful attitude.
Absolutely, yeah. We have had that conversation, and as far as we know, there wasn't anybody else in our family that he abused. There was a doctor told my mom along the way that it could have been partial dementia. He was, you know, older, and it could have been in part due to just kind of not exactly knowing where he is, who he's with, that kind of a thing. I'm not sure I ever bought that story, and I can see it as plausible. But the one conversation I did have with my mom around the abuse that stands out the most when I think about this is when I was in my mid-20s, I said something along the lines of, you know, it's so strange to me how, you know, 3 to 5 months, it's kind of vague how long it really was, but such a brief period of time has such a profound impact on, you know, so many different areas of my life. And she just stopped and said, what do you mean 3 to 5 months? And I discovered in that moment that she had thought that that day when she saw what was going on was the only time. And it just really struck home for me how little we had talked about the abuse after it had happened, and how, you know, so much of what I was experiencing and dealing with was so disconnected from what she thought had really happened, you know? So we had completely different stories and different experiences of what had happened.
Right. Yeah.
Well, you know what I really identified strongly with was the freezing up that you mentioned in the first instance. And like you, I was around the same age, and I had no knowledge of anything sexual or or really anything about life. No, my parents had not bothered to teach me anything about life on life's terms. So when the man that accosted me, the original guy, touched me for the first time, I went stiff as a board, and I froze like a deer in a headlight. And then I eventually, I guess squirmed away from him and so forth. But he had found, and then I didn't go and report it, so he had found a victim. And that meant that he could come back and back and back and back, which he did. But I really remember the initial reaction was really just freezing, not knowing what to do, not knowing what was happening, and being, so terrified that I went stiff.
Yeah.
Let's ask Carol what she thought about what she's heard so far. Carol, a comment or a question about what Rachel talked about and her youth?
Well, Rachel, first of all, I want to thank you, for being on the show, and I want to welcome you to our family, and I mean that from the bottom of my heart.
Thank you, Carol.
I'm really sorry you had to go through that. Any kids that go through abuse like that, whether it's one time, whether it's 3 months, with me it was a year and a half. It started when I was six with an uncle. It doesn't. You don't measure. There's no yardstick on it because it does its damage. And, I think many times parents, I can't say that in my case, but I think parents many times do feel, not only do they feel sad, but they feel like they're guilty because maybe they should have picked up on something. I don't buy the theory either that with the dementia part, I don't believe that. I think probably he had probably touched children when he was younger. I just get that sense that maybe he probably had. But, of course, none of us know that, for a fact. I am sorry you went through that. I really am.
Thanks, Carol. Yeah, I think it's really, one of my things that I say often is trauma is not a competition. And I noticed that oftentimes in working with my clients that one of the first hurdles to get over is giving them permission and helping them to give themselves permission to really just say, this experience, whether it was once, whether it was over the course of many years, mm-hmm. it has had an impact on me, and I'm, going to honor that and, do the work that I need to do around it in order to move on. But until we can embrace the impact of what has happened instead of minimizing it or dismissing it, it's hard to get started in a journey of recovery as long as we're still kind of denying or dismissing what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Or minimizing it by saying it wasn't as bad as what somebody else,
Do you have a relationship with your mother today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, my relationship with both of my parents didn't suffer terribly much, other than my terrible teens when I was just, I was so... I think they survived me more than I survived them.
We all know about the terrible teens.
I talk to my mom on a pretty regular basis. I actually just went home for the first time in 5 years this past April and went to my grandfather's grave actually for the very first time. Mm-hmm. And I had some unfinished business I discovered. And wanted to have kind of a moment there. But, it was great to kind of be there and be back home and back in the small town. And so much has changed and so much has stayed the same. Kind of a feeling, but luckily the abuse didn't lead to a real breakdown in those relationships.
No, you're very fortunate for that. I'm happy for you with that. I'd like to hear
now when
that.
You when you when you when it was revealed that you're that something to your mom at least, and I guess to your dad, that something had happened with grandpa. You said you were the youngest of three. Were your older siblings included in the acknowledgement of what had happened? And did they come to your aid, or did they talk to you about it later? Or because sometimes older kids will try and put a younger kid under their arm or under their wing, mm-hmm. so to speak. Any of that happen?
Yeah, I don't know. I think there was such a distance in age between myself and my siblings that we never had a very, very close relationship. So my brother's 10 years older and my sister is 9 years older. So they certainly knew what had happened. I never got any grief from them. I'll say that. There was never any, you're making this up, or why don't you just get over it, or, any of that. It was more a matter of, okay, we know this has happened, and now let's go have dinner. it was kind of a we don't know how to talk about it. We don't know if we want to talk about it. So it was almost more like an agreed upon silence, like an unspoken agreement that we just wouldn't really dig into it. You know, in my older, you know, in my teenage years, in my 20s, I had maybe a conversation or two with my sister about what happened. And, you know, they certainly know about the work that I do and have read, you know, the book, which, you know, I share along with lessons and skills and tools. You know, I'm sharing a bit of my story along the way in the guidebook as well. So they have those pieces.
By the way, in case you joined us a little bit late, you're talking to, we are talking to Rachel Grant from San Francisco, who is a coach who specializes in trauma recovery and relationship issues. She has a website at rachelgrantcoaching.com. Rachel Grant Coaching is spelled R-A-C-H-E-L-G-R-A-N-T, coaching.com, all one word. And on the website, she offers a couple of kind of interesting things. First of all, she told us that she would be willing to send people the first couple of chapters of her of one of the works that she's done, and that's actually a part of the description of the show tonight. So you might in the future get some requests for that too. But parts one and two of her guidebook, Beyond Surviving, The Final Stages in Recovery from Sexual Abuse, she'll send to you for just for the request. And what is your book's full name? I don't have it. Or is that it?
That's it. You got it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's it.
All right. I said it right. She also offers, which Carl referred to, a free 60-minute session. Wow. That's pretty generous. Off of the website. No, that's great.
Yeah,
you know,
I think it's a great way to, you know, get to know people and have the opportunity to have the conversation about, you know, what they'd like to do in coaching and if coaching is really a good fit for them and if they're at the right place in life to really take on, you know, the work. If they're looking at the Beyond Surviving program, you know, I also do the relationship coaching as well, but I like it as an initial way for people to get to know me as well and to really get a sense if we'd be a good match to work together.
Okay. Now, that we've recently seen the word coaching come up, and I mean in the last decade or so, I guess I've seen it, maybe a little more.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, I never heard of coaching in terms of, you know, of the kinds of things that you do. But it was always psychiatry and psychology and therapy and counseling and so forth. Now people are using the word coaching, and I was wondering if you could give us a little bit of a feel for, you know, what coaching entails and how it might be different from some of these other words that we're maybe more familiar with. But just to let people know what coaching is, can you give us a little description, perhaps?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, the field of coaching has actually been around since the 60s and 70s, and it was initially used or practiced more in organizational planning and as consultants who were hired to kind of work with managers or executives in improving performances and processes in companies. But over time, there was a shift, and so the focus kind of moved to actually helping individuals. And coaching, I actually did go into completing my master's in counseling and with the eye towards doing therapy. But as I dug into the, you know, world of therapy a little bit more and more, I realized that what really compels me about coaching is the opportunity to interact with clients in a way that I'm just better suited for. So I would say the first distinction between therapy and coaching that I would make is that I'm able to share with my clients more openly about my own journey. And so therapists aren't necessarily, you know, lawfully, you know, blocked from doing this. They call it self-disclosing, right? But in the world of therapy, it's often, you know, you really are geared towards not doing that and doing it very seldom. But I really found that in working with my clients that one thing I really craved during my journey was I wanted to talk to somebody who had gone through it and could tell me, well, you know, I really remember those days where I was so angry, you know, I was throwing things, and now today, you know, I've reached this place and I have these skills and I have these ways of coping and I have, you know, peace and calm. And I wanted to be able to talk about those things with someone. And I find that my clients really appreciate the fact that I can, you know, resonate with them on their with their stories and tell them, here's something that happened to me. Here's exactly what I went through. And so, you know, what that then does is that the techniques and the lessons that I share in the Beyond Surviving program become not just ideas, but are actually, you know, what I've used through my own journey. And so, you know, while my sessions never become all about me, I think my clients are encouraged and motivated by the stories that I really share with them. And so I would say also that one of the main distinctions that I make between therapy and coaching is that therapy is really kind of working with a dysfunctional person to bring them to a place of functioning, right? Identifying, diagnosing, perhaps putting, you know, medication, those sorts of things. Whereas I think of coaching as taking somebody who's mostly functioning, right? But they're just, it's giving them an extra boost to really achieve this greater level of freedom, authenticity, connection, whatever. I kind of think of it as taking somebody who's stuck and moving them to being unstuck so that they can get past whatever is kind of holding them back. And, and through a collaborative effort. So I'm not, you know, just telling them exactly what to do. We're exploring it together. We're figuring out the roadmap together using the things that I've created as a guide, but really being able to take their own personal story and use it to inform the coaching, which also stays very focused on the present and the future. So even while we're using the past experience to inform the work we're doing, it's not about going back into the past and reliving anything. We're not trying to re-experience. We're not trying to dig down into all the deep levels of psychology and the mind. Really what we're trying to do is look at what is your present experience, what is unsatisfying, or are you just causing you discontent, and what can we do to shift that and move you into the next step and the next phase or next stage of your life.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes a lot of sense to me. You know, I'm a person that got into recovery through a 12-step program, and they have, of course, in those programs, they have what are called sponsors. And sponsors are really just people who have been there before you. You know, they've got a little more experience and hopefully some sobriety under their belt and so forth. And they have, and they do share their own experience, strength, and hope. They do occasionally recommend things that you do. Supposedly the best sponsors make suggestions. They don't tell you what to do because you have to make up your own mind. But they do freely share what happened to them and what they did about it and so forth. And it sounds, I can understand it on that level pretty easily. And it sounds pretty exciting, actually. Now, when a client, how do clients come to you? You call them clients or patients or what do you call them?
I call them clients, right? People. Okay. Yeah. Most of the time they find me through Google Ads. I kind of, you know, I'm doing some marketing. A word of mouth is also really, really helpful. Past clients who I've worked with who have, you know, shared about the work that they've done. It's an interesting thing. You know, as far as coaching goes, the field has really been focused quite more on relationship coaching is very popular, but like career, business, executive coaching, all of those are really firmly planted and I think very well developed. The idea of going to a coach for doing work around sexual abuse recovery, and I also work with other abuse survivors, so physical abuse, emotional abuse. I just take the program and kind of curtail it, you know, modify it for them.
Sure.
But it's not necessarily in the mind of people right away to go, oh, a coach, right? So oftentimes, you know, people look for, you know, sexual abuse therapists, and they might see my ad off to the side that says, you know, and I think, you know, I'm starting to get some readership for my blog, but that is part of the work that I'm doing kind of in the background is raising awareness that doing coaching as a modality to work, do this work of recovery is a really great option for people. Therapy, I think, has a really wonderful place and role in the journey of recovery. But my frustration with therapy, part of the reason why I actually didn't go into therapy additionally too, is I didn't want to be stuck in the space of talk with no action.
Yep.
And while not all therapists take this road, I certainly, in my experience, often had that got into that place of, okay, I've identified behaviors, I understand why they're there, I've uncovered all of the layers of psychology that explain why my behavior is the way it is. But every time I got to that place of, well, what do I do about it? How do I actually intervene or change? I just got the blank stares. And so for me, I think, you know, the coaching is really about answering that question of, you know, what do you do about it? Once you've identified a behavior, a pattern of thought or a pattern of behavior that you want to change. And it's a good space for people who are ready. You know, I think that there was a time in my life when I kind of think of recovery as three stages, victim, survivor, and beyond surviving. And when I was in the survivor stage, able to talk about the fact that I had been abused, identified myself as a survivor, and was starting to kind of try to piece together and acknowledge that it had an impact on my life and I wanted to do something about it, therapy was a great place to be because it was a safe space where I could talk openly and freely about what I was feeling and thinking, and I didn't have to worry about really confronting it or changing it. I just had to acknowledge what was going on. But I certainly got to that place where I got sick of that and thought, all right, what's next? I'm ready to do something about it. And I think that's that final stage of beyond surviving, when you're ready to move into that next step.
No, I totally agree. A lot of us as part of this organization put our names on our website as available to take calls or emails, either one, from people. And in the end, I find that I'm doing a lot of, I guess it's more similar to coaching than anything else. I certainly don't have any degrees in anything except life, you know. But I've, like, Carol, nearly three decades worth of recovery. And so I consider myself, significantly along this journey. And I have lots to go still. But I speak from my own perspective. But then I often will ask somebody, what are you going to do about it? And they go, huh? You know, because that's, you're right. It's a different kind of approach from psychiatry, has you sit on the couch and talk until you can maybe someday come to understand yourself, so that if you can understand yourself, you can get up off the couch and go do something. And I go, you don't need to understand it. You need to start doing things that are different, and the understanding will come. You know, it's the opposite approach. All right, let's see.
Yeah, and I think that...
Go ahead.
Oh, I'll just say real quick. I think that, I collaborate and I have a lot of therapists in my network, and I appreciate them so much because I do have people who come to me who are not ready for Beyond Surviving. It's just too confronting, you know, because a lot of what the work of Beyond Surviving is about is, you know, taking away the abuse as the excuse for why you do things, right?
Exactly.
And you have to start taking responsibility and making choices. And so people who aren't ready for that, you know, therapy is a great place for them to land. And hopefully they land there for only a little while. You know, they don't hit that couch and stay there for 20 years.
And one of the things I think will eventually someday help a lot is when we have significant numbers of groups of people available, you know, that you can meet with on a weekly basis, like 12-step programs do. You know, we just don't have anything like this for survivors of childhood trauma. Instead, we want to keep it all a secret. That's the that's kind of the hallmark of the whole thing, and the beginning of recovery is, you know, the letting go of the secret. And if you can do that, and you find a group of people who, like you, are along a similar path, that's a great way, you know, to figure out that you're not alone, you're not the only one that ever happened to, and so forth. You have to become responsible and get on with your life, and blah blah blah. All right, let's see what Carl has learned in the last few minutes here, and he has a question or comment, I'm sure. Carl, you back with us? You're on the air with Rachel.
Yeah, I have to admit that as Bill and Carol both know, I'm involved with an organization that's an online support group for male survivors, and it's called Men Thriving, and it's just an online forum where we all talk, and we talk and talk a lot and post and respond to. And in a sense, to me, that's kind of what we're doing also, is that coaching idea. None of us are licensed therapists. None of us are trained to counsel people in the sense of psychology or counseling. But we share our life experiences and try to enlighten each other as to what the next step might be. But I also know that so many of them have become dependent on that psychiatrist, that person that they've been seeing and that their insurance is paying for on a weekly basis to go and spend time with. or biweekly, whatever it might be. And those people that are stuck with that psychiatrist-type setup, to me, never seem to, like you say, get off. It's like, I should say, I won't say, it's like get off the pot or do the other thing. And they don't seem to want to get off the pot. They're just going to sit there and keep talking. And I love that concept of what you're talking about here. The other thing I do like, and we've frequently mentioned this, is the fact that one of the things that you need to do when you're looking for a professional that you want to work with is to, I call it a job interview. You're paying their bill, or you're paying them, so you're the customer, and to meet with that person and kind of get the idea of what their strategy is and what you want out of the situation. And that 1 hour worth of free service that you offer online gives them that opportunity to kind of do that job interview with a 1 hour. And I love that concept of it very much so. So I think you're right on the right track, because there's too many of us that are stuck in the situation where we just like to talk about it, but we never do anything about it. Whereas coaching people and getting them to move is the thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I appreciate that, Carl, and I'm excited about the forum that you have going on. That's really wonderful that you're doing that. I have found one program that's kind of like a 12-step. It's Adult Survivors of Child Abuse, and their website is ASCA support.org, and I actually have a monthly meeting that I do once a month in San Francisco that is like that. You know, we come together, it's an open forum, people come, there's a bit of structure to it. I toss in a little bit of coaching. Not all ASCA groups will have that available, obviously, but they're nationwide, and they're trying to kind of create that space where people can come and get that just open support and talk through their story and hear other people share their stories through kind of, they have 21 steps their book is based on, and I really like that. But I think that part of, you know, getting through those stages, I think we have to move through those stages. I think it is important, and I've certainly seen, you know, I've had clients who have said, yes, I'm ready, I'm going to start, and then, you know, about 4 sessions in, you know, they kind of disappear, and sometimes I can pull them along. Sometimes I realize, no, this is not a good time for them. They're not really ready yet. Because getting to that space where the abuse really is no longer your crutch and you have to move into life and say, well, if this is the choice that I'm making, it's because I'm making that choice and not because it's as informed by some false belief that I have as a result of the abuse. And that can be kind of confronting. And I think the other thing that comes up is, I certainly went through this, is after 20 years of identifying myself as somebody who was abused, there was this real moment of, well, God, if I take that away, what's left, right? Or if I'm not dealing with my issues, what am I going to do? Or who am I going to be if I take away, if I let go of these things? So there can be this real confrontation of identity that happens when people start doing that work.
A big fear, yeah. But you know what? Carl used the word stuck, and I think it's true. A lot of people get stuck in their recovery. Okay, I've shared about it. Now what? You know, and there's plenty of other things that can be recommended to them to try that are going to bring them different results, other than, you know, as they say, just doing the same thing over and over. But I also want to mention, Rachel, that we are big supporters of ASCA. Have that as one of the things. You know, we have a whole section of our website that's devoted to different kinds of therapies and different choices that people can make. And while we don't try to force them into any one type, we list them all. And we say, you know, you have to make up your own mind. But there are a lot of avenues available. And among them are these so-called self-help groups. And ASCA support is one of them that we list. We give their 21 steps. I've trained in ASCA. I am a facilitator. I just haven't settled enough to start a group yet. But I've helped other groups get started, and I've attended a bunch of those meetings. And another group is the Lamplighters, and those are the only two
that
I know of that have significant numbers. And unfortunately, the Morris Center is closed, so it's not supporting the ASCA thing. So we're on our own as facilitators. And, you know, I work with John and Stu from Chicago, and the new lady that you have starting a group, the three of us have been rallying with, who found ASCA through us here, and we send people to ASCA all the time. But that we don't have a particular thing that we recommend over anything else, since we have our own experiences, and one of them is
sure.
ASCA.
Yeah.
And, you know, so if people are looking for that information, they go to askasupport.org. All right, Carol's up. Carol. Ooh, I almost forgot Carol. I can't forget Carol.
Don't do that. Let me tell you something. Coaching is becoming more and more popular now in these days. Therapy over the years has changed a lot, too, because years ago they used to have people, you know, really focus on their past. And you can get stuck, like Carl says. You can, and you become dependent on the therapist. And people expect the therapist to fix them. And people have to fix themselves. Yes, they need guidance. Yes, they need help to do that. That's very, very true. People who have terrible lives that they came from, you know, like with myself, where I was terribly abused. Carl was abused, and of course, Bill was terribly abused also. Sometimes you need a little bit more work, and you have to do more work. But if you do stay with a therapist for too long, you want that therapist to do your work. And what you have to do is learn how to work for yourself. Now, this is one thing that I found out. I have shared my life with a lot of kids that I've worked with because it made them open up. When they find out that you're abused too or had been abused, you were a victim of abuse, they would open up. And that usually that's frowned upon, in psychology, but I always did it because it made them comfortable. You know what I'm saying by that? And because they saw you as a person that they could, you know, relate to. So I wouldn't give them all the information of my life, but I would certainly share a large part of it. And that way we would talk back and forth. Actually, in doing that, I healed myself. I was able to heal through that. And they, too, were able to heal. I call it the healing journey. With coaching, I think it's very good. You don't have to give out meds. You don't end like with psychiatry. You don't have to worry about medication and things like that. And you are more open. You tend to be more open, and it is a much more relaxed, I think, atmosphere. I do very much do believe in self-help groups like ASCA. I think that's a good way to go. And so keep the good work up.
Well, I always say, Rachel, that if somebody really asks me, that my belief is that it's helpful to have both, to have an individual who knows your whole story or who you feel you can really trust and you can, you know, not have secrets with and so forth. But also a group dynamic is really important because then you're sharing. You don't get up that many opportunities to tell your whole story, but you find out, you know, that's not really necessary. You can tell the appropriate parts when it comes up. You find out that you're not alone, that mm-hmm. there are other people who have experienced things similar to you. You're not unique. You're not the only one and so forth. This is a big deal to those of us who come from a background of child abuse because we all think we're unique. We're the only one it happened to, or there's so few of us, we'll never find anybody else. So I am a big proponent of us doing whatever we can to not, you know, to foster this concept of setting up groups. San Francisco, of course, is the home base for ASCA, and there's a number of groups in San Francisco. I wish it was that way in every major city in our country.
Everywhere.
But unfortunately, there's about 50 or maybe a few more official ASCA groups on the website, and the Lamplighters, the other group that I mentioned, they have 90 groups, and some of those are in foreign countries. But, you know, when you consider the number of people who are out here suffering and who could use the kind of support that we're talking about, Rachel, it's beyond belief to me that we don't have more willingness to set these things up in at least every major city, once a week or something, or every 2 weeks, you know, but that's not the case right now. Let's see. The next thing I wanted to talk about was, all right, so you can't get paid by an insurance program. Are all your patients there for or clients, sorry, they pay you cash? How does that work?
That's right. Yeah, no insurance coverage as of yet.
Right.
We're really hoping that that will change down the road. But there has to be a little bit more licensing and, I think, structure around the coaching world before that were to happen. So my clients do pay per session. I also offer, if the Beyond Surviving program is 16 sessions, the other, you know, another part for me is, you know, if I have a coaching client who's still working with me after 4 years or so, you know, I'm doing something wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not the idea. It's, you know, they should come in, do the work, and then be out living their lives. And they may want to check in, you know, on a monthly basis or every other month basis to just get tune-ups. But I certainly don't want anyone on my, you know, virtual couch for a long time. So there's the package price, whether you do the Beyond Surviving program, which is 16 sessions, or the Relationship Communication, which is 10. And if you pay for the package up front, the program up front, then you get a 20% off. And I really try to work with my clients to make it affordable for them. So I also offer a sliding scale option so people can, you know, who are having trouble, especially in this economy, you know, they want to get the help, they want to do the work, then, you know, I try to make it as accessible to people as possible.
So a typical course of action would be 16 sessions. Is that once a week? So four months worth? Roughly?
That's right. Yeah, I let the person choose whether they, you know, can fit into their life coaching once a week or every other week based on their budget, based on their time. And also the program is set up so that they're reading a lesson and then doing reflection work and then also doing homework. So it also is a matter of how quickly a person kind of integrates new ideas and how much time they want to practice a new skill or concept between calls. And I do all of the coaching right now by phone and Skype.
Okay.
So I can do, you know, have a face-to-face via Skype, which is a great tool. And so we just have, you know, a 55-minute hour call and do it that way. I also am working on a workshop. So coming up in July, July 21st here in San Francisco, I'll have an all-day workshop, which will cover what I would normally cover in three sessions during the day. And it's only going to be $35, really accessible, really, really accessible. So I'm hoping to do that and get more groups going. Beyond Surviving, in its initial look, how it was initially formulated, was as a small group for a community of women that I was in. And we would meet once a week, and it was completely free. And I used a Shelter from the Storm, which is this great book by Cynthia Kubitin, as kind of the guide. But I had built in a lot of the conversations and ideas that had made such a difference for me along the way. And so once I finished my master's and I started thinking about, okay, I really want to do coaching as the job, and what do I want to build from that, I decided to go back and rewrite a book so that it was really completely my own program, you know, top to bottom. I, you know, I reference things from Shelter from the Storm here and there because there are some great exercises and tools. But but yeah, so my biggest hope is to have the Beyond Surviving groups, because having, you know, eight women or eight men in a room working together, I think there's just such power in that. And dispelling all the things you've been talking about, you know, okay, you know, I'm not crazy. Other people have these same thoughts. People have these same struggles. I'm not alone. And being able to see how somebody takes a lesson or a skill and applies it to their lives might inspire you to, you know, give it a try, even if you're scared. And I've just seen really great things happen, you know, with that. But when it stops being free, it's a little bit trickier these days. But you know, I'm really hoping to get those out there. And, you know, big idea vision, you know, if I, you know, put my vision out to the world, is that, you know, there are Beyond Surviving programs around the country, you know, similar to ASCO, similar to Lamplighters, that people are trained in leading, you know, Beyond Surviving groups and workshops, and can get it out there.
Yeah, well, I mean, I do it every day. It's just I do it. I don't have the guts maybe to charge anything for it. I don't know what the reason for me. But anyway, we're talking to Rachel Grant. She's got a lot of great energy, and she does coaching, and she specializes in her coaching in trauma recovery and relationship coaching. Her website is at rachelgrantcoaching.com. We want to open the phone lines up. I should have done so a few minutes ago, maybe. But anyway, 646-595-2118, and we still have a half an hour left in the show, so plenty of time for you if you're out there listening to call in, and we encourage this, of course. We have had people in our chat room throughout the evening, but we'd like a couple of them to call in now. 646-595-2118. And Rachel's website at Rachel, R-A-C-H-E-L, Grant, G-R-A-N-T, coaching.com, Rachel Grant Coaching, it's all one word. You will find a variety of different kinds of offers. For example, Rachel writes a blog that I've now come to know. She makes appearances on shows like this on a fairly regular basis. She has her Beyond Surviving workshop that she says coming up in July listed on the website. A free 60-minute session is listed on the website. And if you're listening to tonight's show, whether it's on the air live or not, it's in a recorded version of the show, Rachel is offering those who are listening parts 1 and 2 of her guidebook, Beyond Surviving the Final Stage in Recovery from Sexual Abuse. You can actually link to that through the description of her show right here in the chat room or in the description of the show that's on our website and so forth. It'll travel with the show's on-demand version, Rachel, so people may in the future ask you, they listen to the show, can I have your first 2 things? You'll have to say yes.
That's great.
She's really passionate about what she believes in, and she has her own recovery to refer to. And she said she thinks it's helpful, and I totally agree, that those of us who do try to work with others have something to offer them. That's why we ask people who have an abuse story to relate it at the top of our show, of course, Rachel. We want people who are listening to, to have a buy-in with the fact that our guests and ourselves on the panel actually have our own life experience and know what we're talking about. We're not talking theoretically. We're talking experientially,
Right.
So, okay. Again, 646-595-2118 for Rachel Grant. I'm going to open Carl and Carol's mics up now again, and we'll just have a general discussion. Have you guys had a chance to look at her website? Lots of stuff there. Lots of free things you can download, too, including, I guess, you've written these things that are listed as free downloads are in your own voice. You wrote these things, Rachel?
Yeah, so the media there, the free downloads, are recordings of other interviews that I've done, speaking topics that I've given. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, Rachel does most of her coaching work, over the phone or by Skype. And so that means that no matter where you are, if you're listening to me on the Internet, you can also listen to her on the coaching telephone line.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, I think I have one client right now who's in San Francisco. Everybody else is in other states. Yeah.
We're all out there if you ask me, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We're all kind of out there. No, we're all out there. I'll make it inclusive. Except Carl. Carl has got his feet firmly on the ground. Right, Carl?
Sure. Yeah, sure. That's why I want her on weekly, so we can have a session here every week.
Right.
Okay. What else do you have coming up? You have a couple other things that you're into, Rachel, and I want to make sure we have time to mention so people are interested they can join you.
Well, I would love for folks to go to my Facebook page, or they can also search. They can search for Rachel Grant Coaching on Facebook to find my page. They can also search for Real Talk with Rachel. It's a group on Facebook, and I'm wanting to hold kind of monthly chats using the group chat feature there on Facebook. So the next one coming up will be June 27th, starting at 7 o'clock p.m. And basically what a person has to do is join the group, be online at the time that the chat starts, and I'll just hit the chat button and we'll have a dialogue. And the first one I just held was an open forum and just let people kind of come in, whatever issues they wanted to bring, they brought, and we had a conversation. And the transcript is also there on the group page. If you go to files, the file tab, so you can look at the transcript from the first one. And then this one coming up is going to be talking about the importance of believing that healing is possible. You know, in the work that I do, this is kind of the very first place that I start is, do you actually really even think that there's another side? Can you envision, can you believe that there's the potential and possibility in you to have a life that isn't tied to the abuse, that isn't locked down, that isn't all about constantly kind of trying to manage and cope and deal with the effects of the abuse, but that you could actually reach a place where you're free and you're living your life and you have the skills and tools to deal with any time when, you know, those old stories or the old beliefs try to kind of rear their ugly heads, and that you're able and capable of doing that. So we're going to have a conversation. We're going to have a little chat about that, and I'll share some of my thoughts and ideas about that and answer any questions that people might have or struggles, or coach them through, you know, how do I get to that place where I can actually really believe that I can heal?
Yeah, I find it interesting at times that one of the frequent topics that comes up in the male support group that I'm on online with is a lot of people refer to it as the old tapes that are running in our head. When we're children and we're abused, we hear, number one, we hear our abusers in their, to be technical about it, the degradation that they push onto us via, the words they say, the things they do to us, creates this tape in our heads that we, as adults, and for the rest of our lives, sometimes replay those tapes. And getting beyond that and realizing that that's their voice, not yours, and that you can turn that around and change those tapes and change what those tapes are saying to you. It's kind of like you're self-conscious talking to yourself, but you are worth something. You're not worthless. It's not your fault. Things like that. There's a lot of that that goes on with survivors that they have to grasp the idea of being able to change those before they can really get into recovery, at least I feel so.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, my work is very much grounded in the philosophy of mind that comes out of Buddhism, that comes out of Christianity, that comes out of spirituality, though it's not a spiritual program, but it's so important to understand, and neurology, the science of how the brain is wired as a result of trauma. And you're exactly right that when we have an experience, the brain on a neurological level makes neuronal connections, and down the road, those neuronal connections are being reinforced, expanded by all of our other experiences. And so every time we have a thought, every time we revisit a thought like, I am worthless, it's kind of like digging the trench a little bit deeper. And, you know, getting ourselves out of that trench has a lot to do with doing other mental work, basically challenging those thoughts. There's this great quote I just read in a book that I'm reading. It says, make your mental company glorious. And I just love that statement, you know, just the idea that, you know, what we are thinking about ourselves, about others, it's not trivial. It really does shape our experience. It shapes how we view ourselves. It shapes how we view other people. And so much of the work that, you know, I do with survivors is about helping them, first of all, uncover those false beliefs. Like, just do that first step of identifying what's running the show. Like, literally, what's going on in the background that's been running things that you might or might not be aware of, bringing those into, you know, high relief, so that we can then start challenge them and doing the work of, you know, replacing them, negating them, whatever we need to do so that they can see the new possibilities and the new selves.
I quote you in the description that we have for the show as saying, what you think you create. And that's true before your recovery and after your recovery. You know, I mean, part of the process is to realize that you are creating your own reality, even with your negative thoughts. So why not change your thoughts to a positive place? Because then there's at least a better chance that your reality will be more positive too. You know, what the results will be more positive. So I believe that's true, that an awful lot of what goes on with us, you know, is a brain thing. And that can be our enemy or it can be our friend, you know, depending on how we treat ourselves and our brain. We have a fantastic set of articles on our feature articles. It's partway down the page now, but it's called The Bomb in the Brain, and it really, it's a video It's a video series, five videos. But if you only listen to one, number three explains what you just referred to, how the development of the brain of the abused person, because of their trauma, occurs in a different way than the normal person, and and which areas are affected and why they're affected, and that is reversible. But the good news is, you know, the brain is resilient. It's really big, and we only use a small part of it. Mm-hmm. So we can actually, you know, replug it in. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, we can create new paths for old thinking to go away and new thinking to, you know, to become in the forefront. Mm-hmm. Anyway, bomb in the brain. It's under our feature article. It's interesting for some people, probably.
My gosh. Yeah.
Now I want to
know. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, you did.
Well,
please.
I was just going to say that I was certainly a relief to me in many ways when I came to understand that so mm-hmm. much of the work had to do with mind and neurology and rewiring. Because when I thought that it was just about somehow reaching like a new self or a new identity or somehow an emotional change that was going to, you know, wash over me and I was going to be cleansed. That was tough. I couldn't figure out how to do that. But when I realized, oh, wait a minute, this is really quite a lot to do with what am I thinking? Am I reinforcing an old thought or am I creating a new thought? Am I reinforcing an old pattern or am I stepping into a new choice? It just started to really click and make sense to me. And it became approachable and workable, like really actionable.
When we realize that our brains are really about chemicals and electronic impulses, that's what they're about. You know, mm-hmm. that's how they operate, and we can retrain them. We can exercise them, and we can put away some of the bad stuff. But more importantly, we can create new good stuff, because they also point out that this destruction of the brain occurs at the point that the child starts to be traumatized, mm-hmm. And so from that point on, their brain doesn't have a chance to develop normally. So we have to go back to a place where we're often pre-adolescent when this occurs. Mm-hmm. But as they say, there's so much capacity in our brains that's unused that we're capable, Homo erectus, to create new paths and create new experiences and new belief systems, because you are what you think. You know, mm-hmm. you really are what you think.
I believe
that.
I tell myself that
more often.
Yeah.
I have to admit that the idea that we can exercise our brains, I've only been exercising my brain and taking it off of jumping jacks for the last 5 years, but Carol and Bill have been doing it for about 30 years, so I think their brains are stronger than mine.
We're sure of that.
Hey,
we know
that.
Hey, what do you mean
you're
sure of that?
Well, we always bust each other.
You got no argument at all.
let me ask you a couple of things. Do you believe in NLP? Are you familiar with NLP?
Break it down. It's narrative. What's it stand for? Neuro-linguistic process,
mm-hmm.
right?
Well, it's all about
positive
self-talk. That's what I was asking. See, well, what I'm picking up from you is you have a lot of positive ways and thoughts in your process there, which is wonderful. Because usually, you know, survivors are always so down on themselves, and they have to, you know, like, they have to be rewired, if you know what I'm saying, because they have so much low self-esteem. What I was wondering with you, what I'm wondering with you is, did you ever suffer from nightmares or any low self-esteem or any post-traumatic stress disorders at all?
No, I never had any very severe symptoms aside from rage. My anger was probably my thorn in my side, along with, I think, devaluing myself, really a low sense of value and worth. When I started doing this work, I remember, you know, part of my process was I would wake up every morning and I would literally just say out loud, like, I am valuable. And my brain would literally feel like it was being poked with a knife. Like, what are you doing? That doesn't fit. That doesn't register. We don't understand what you're doing. And over time, you know, the thought became more and more integrated and more a part of actually who I was. And, of course, there are other steps and other pieces, but it's not just about, you know, positive affirmation. I don't think just believing you're beautiful makes you beautiful, right? Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. in believing that you're beautiful, you might then end up taking actions that support your beauty, right? Like you might take a shower, or you might do your hair, or you might do your nails, or whatever makes you feel beautiful. And if more than anything, your essence becomes beautiful. And then when you're in the room, what you present and what you walk in with is, I am beautiful. And people get that. People are drawn to that. You know, that's what people connect to.
That's so true.
And,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, I just had to do a lot of work around, you know, kind of around the anger, around the rage that I had, which was a bit of a different technique than kind of the neurological rewiring stuff. That was a bit more behavioral. But, mm-hmm. but yeah. It's all in there.
And mine was more a spiritual approach. I think Carol had a similar experience, but it was more a spiritual approach because that's what the 12-step programs taught me. And I fortunately fell in with a 12-step group that allowed me to talk about my child abuse, and that's where I did my therapy too. So I not only got sober and clean, but I also got clear on some of my issues, and I shared them often enough so they were no longer at least a secret with the groups. You know, people knew that's right, that's who I was, and it was no longer a secret to them anyway. But spiritual, you know, whether it's work with affirmations, which is a kind of a, you know, talking to yourself and verifying you are beautiful, for example. Or what was the one you woke up with every day, Rachel? I'm sorry.
Oh, I am valuable.
Valuable, right. I am valuable. Yeah. That's a statement of fact that if you can come to believe it or through prayer, you can come to believe it, you know, you are, in fact, following a kind of a spiritual process that helps a great deal. You know, I think, and that's just my opinion.
Yeah, I think it's so much about shifting your focus, right? Because
yeah,
when you're
yes.
in the space of I am not valuable, you go out into the world, and boy, you gather all the evidence you need for that. You date the
that's
wrong
right.
men, you make the worst friends, you take the worst job. It's, you know, it's not even so much that you really are that, it's just that you get the reinforcement. And so when it comes to being valuable, it's not even that you really are or you aren't. It's just that what are you going to see? What are you going to notice? What are you going to focus on in your life? And as
yes.
you start to make those shifts, you know, I am yes. valuable to some people. I'm not valuable to other people. But at the base of it, when I come from the space of I am valuable, I have something to give, I have something to offer, then that gives mm-hmm. me a certain way of being and approaching and walking and talking that
mm-hmm.
that I think changes the way that I live my life. And so
mm-hmm.
I have more experiences that reinforce value than devalue.
Mm-hmm. That whole,
so it's not
I
like
am
a magic
beautiful
pill.
Thing.
Yeah.
No, but that whole I am valuable thing.
You can't just say it and be it. You have to then do something.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. I cut you off. Go for it.
No, I was just going to point out to Carol that whole I am beautiful thing is where Carl excels beyond us. He's saying that.
Rachel, if you do start coming on a regular basis, the one thing that I want from you is assistance in that rage situation. I really think that's what was one of my lingering effects. I didn't have as much of the post-traumatic or anything else, but the rage was there, and I guarantee you that if you can help me with that rage, the clerks at the fast food restaurants where I order my hamburgers will be very happy because I get very upset if I don't get the right number of pickles on my hamburger. That's amazing to me how that misplaced anger, and I joke about it, but it is, I mean, it's not necessarily just that. It's anything that I order, if I'm paying for it, I want it the way I want it, and unfortunately, I do get upset when it doesn't come that way. So mm-hmm. you would make a lot of restaurant people happy if you could get me over my rage situation.
Absolutely, yeah. Right, and
but
so,
have,
you mean, that's
you
a perfect
a
example.
Uh-huh.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, I
was just going to say, that's a perfect example. I don't want to coach necessarily Carl, but that's a perfect example where we could start to look at one of the key things you just said there is, I want it the way that I want it. right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so it's not that, it's not the pickles, it's not the things one off, it's that it's threatening you getting things the way that you want it. And so exploring what it is about not getting things the way that you want it, like what's the fear and concern about that, that leads you to the underlying space and belief that's driving all of the behavior in the first place that then would be worked on and do some work around.
Wow. Okay. and I think you're right, though. I mean, when we were kids or when we were abused, and my sexual abuse came about at the hands of a scout leader who I put a lot of trust into, and he took 8 months to groom me. And that whole, at the time I needed a positive adult male role model in my life, and I didn't get it at that time because he then turned around and used that against me. And I think it set up that pattern of not getting a need met. And whether or not that comes down to why I have such a problem with restaurants and food preparation, I don't know. But I assume that's got something to do with it, definitely. And what do you mean you don't want to counsel me? What do you mean you don't want to counsel me? I heard you say that. I heard you say that at the beginning of that.
Because I didn't ask for permission. I just went into it. So I didn't ask you if you wanted coaching around it. So I was kind of disclaiming that I'm going to put an idea out there, but don't feel obligated to take it and do anything with it.
Well, if I haven't made it clear, I want you here regularly to coach me. And we'll call it a radio program, not me paying for coaching. Sorry.
Awesome.
I'm kind of cheap
like
that
it.
Way, by the way, by the way.
I don't know if I want Carl to get too healthy too fast. We need him as our kind of our class clown and everything around here. So he's working. He actually wears a red nose on occasion, Rachel. You don't
nice.
So,
no. Yeah, only when there's a contest involved.
We have a lot of fun here. You know, I hope people can hear. You know, that are hearing this. Say, what are they laughing about? They were all abused children. Well, yeah. But we're all okay about it at this point. Mm-hmm. We're at various stages, perhaps, in our healing journey, but we're all on one, and we can joke about it, and we can have fun, and it's okay. But there's a dead seriousness underneath everything we do, where we really are conscious of the fact that an awful lot of kids are being abused right now as we talk. There's a phone call made or a tip made every 10 seconds in our country, Rachel, every 10 seconds to a hotline reporting child abuse. And yet only 1 out of 10 cases is ever reported. So imagine if they were all reported, we wouldn't have enough people, operators.
Answer
the
phone. No way.
Yeah. You know, and when we think about it, we know, you know, the facts are hard to address to ascertain, but they say that at a minimum, 39 or 40 million of us have been sexually assaulted, all as adults now. And again, the vast majority of us have kept it a secret and are still holding on to the secret. And only a tiny number in comparison to the 39 or 40 million have ever gotten into recovery. So there's a lot of work to do. There's a lot of people walking around wounded. And perhaps you're one of them if you're listening right now. Well, you can have what we have if you're willing to do a few of the things that we did, and we're here to help you. And that's the whole concept behind what we do, is to offer recovery options to people who are still suffering, and, of course, to do whatever we can in terms of prevention and intervention to lessen the statistics, which are dramatic and just unbelievable, even to us. That so many kids are susceptible in every walk of life. Every walk of life, every kind of kid, everywhere kids are gathered, they are susceptible, period. And, you know, yet we only hear about a few of the cases that rise to the level of being nationally important enough to make the media. When we do that, we have to take the opportunity to remind you that behind every one of those cases, there are literally thousands of other cases going on. And yeah, that one case might be in the news right now, but there are an awful lot of people who are suffering. The whole family suffers, as Rachel said before, and we agree with that. In their own ways, everybody in the family is traumatized when only one person, you know, goes through the experience. But It's also, Rachel, also often a family disease that gets passed on generation to generation. And if whatever we can do to break the cycle, we're going to,
yeah.
You know, in our cases.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of one of those things, like, this is a job I would like to go out of business. Like, I would really like to go out of business and only be able to do the relationship coaching. But, yeah, there are so many people doing some great work, you know, on the prevention side of things. And, I myself personally am not dug into that very deeply, but it certainly seems like a great place to put some energy and some focus to figure out, you know, what is going on in the psychology and the culture that, you know, has this as such a dominant, it's an epidemic.
Absolutely an epidemic. And, we try to, we don't want to spread ourselves too thin. So the part that we don't pay as much attention to are the legal aspects and the criminal aspects, because, you know, kind of law enforcement has to take care of that for us. We're not lawyers or anything like that. But we follow some of that just so we're informed. But our main focus is, you know, promoting whatever we can that we think, because we don't belong to anybody else. We're free to do what we want here. We're a grassroots organization. So we promote whatever we can find that we think is legitimate that'll help a person who's already suffered get into recovery in their adulthood, or that we think is useful in terms of prevention and intervention, especially for parents and caregivers who are concerned about children. How can they help them? What are the signs they look for? How do you report it? And so forth. And anything we find that's legitimate goes on our website. We're free to share anything we want without that permission. You know, so coaching, of course, is one of those things that we would certainly want people to know we enthusiastically include as a possible route for you to investigate. And like Carl said earlier, you know, it's up to you to find some coaching opportunities that are out there. And just like a therapist, you would have to interview individuals to find out who it is you're most comfortable with. But Rachel, for example, gives you a free 60-minute session to do that. So you'll have plenty of time to see if you're comfortable working with Rachel or not. But, you know, there's also ministry. There's also psychiatry, psychology. There's 12-step groups. There's self-help organizations. There's all kinds of ways. There's career counseling. There's all kinds of things. And they're all possible paths to recovery. And we list, you know, all of them, because the person has to make up their mind about. But one of them is certainly coaching. We have 2.5 minutes left, so I'm going to ask Carol and Carl for some quick final thoughts. I know Rachel had one, too. So, Carol, can you give us a final thought?
Yeah. I find that, you know, what you said was very, very interesting. I think you're awesome. And I very much agree with a lot of the things you said. And please do come back again.
Absolutely. Yeah, you've got great energy. You're quite an extrovert.
Yeah, energy. Oh, my goodness. I love it. I love it.
Carl, were you infected?
I'm definitely infected, but I also think that we need her back on a regular basis, like I say, for coaching here.
I'm glad I'm back with that one. Good.
Feel free to come back anytime you'd like. Anytime you've got that 5 to 6:30 time limit there in San Francisco available, feel free to come back. And, if nothing else, when I get back out to San Francisco to visit, I'll look you up for a cup of coffee, if nothing else, so that you can beat it into my head with in person instead of over the radio. So, I'll ask everybody.
With your red nose. You'll have your red nose on, right?
Well,
please do.
If it's Halloween, yes, but otherwise, you know. But anyway, I'll tell everybody to be good to yourselves because you deserve it, and say goodnight to everyone.
Right. And I'll mention to Rachel that if she does meet Carl, she should bring a flashlight because his head is a dark place. Rachel, you have a couple final thoughts? You have about a minute or so.
Sure. Well, first of all, I just want to thank Carl, Carol, Bill, all of you for being so wonderful and gracious and welcoming. I really appreciate that. And just for giving me the opportunity to share my story and talk about my work. And you know, for me, I guess what I would say to anyone listening is that, you know, sometimes making that first choice to step up and start taking on to do the work of recovery, that can sometimes be the scariest and hardest first step. And then after that, can kind of be a breeze. And so, you know, if you're just curious and wondering and thinking about, you know, what could I do? Would this really work? I know there's often that feeling of, oh, I've tried so many things. So many other things that I've tried just didn't seem to make the difference. But I really have feel like I have something that is really of value, and I love sharing it with people. I really want it to be accessible and available. So please don't let any thoughts like, oh, I don't have enough money or I don't have enough time, don't let that stuff get in the way. You know, your life is yours. Start living it today. Take it, you know, by the horns and go with it. And, you know, my hope for people is that they really can just understand that life can be more than just surviving, that they really can, you know, live their lives, live powerfully, live free and happy.
That's wonderful. And you're now a member of our family, little sister. You come back anytime you want. Just drop in. You don't have to coach anybody. You just be one of us, you know. And we'd love to have you anytime. And it's easy to find us. We're on the air 6 nights a week, every night except Saturday, and always commence our shows at 6 o'clock. At 8 o'clock Eastern, so 5 o'clock Pacific. And then, of course, all the shows are recorded and available on demand, certainly by the next morning. So this is Bill Murray for Rachel Grant, for Carl Hart, for Carol D. Levine, for Vicky, and for Chris in the chat room, and a couple of guests whose names I didn't catch. Thanking you for listening tonight and reminding you that my belief is that God bless you, and God bless America, and God bless adult survivors of child abuse.
Blog Talk Radio.